Hello and welcome back to Not Just Paleo. I'm your host, Evan Brand, and I got a lot of big news, and man, I am busy and doing what I told you not to do in my book, Stress Solutions, which is bite off more than you can chew. I don't think that I have necessarily, but it definitely feels that way sometimes when you look at the to-do list. But anyway, welcome to the show, and today's guest is Dr. Albert Mensa, a medical doctor who will blow your mind today on the reason why vegetables may not be your best food choice, especially if you're suffering from anxiety, depression, or bipolar, any type of mood disorder. It's really amazing, and it's really opened up a new pathway of thought and research for me and is part of my new testing protocol. So if you haven't heard from the last episodes, I'm offering some very accurate urinary, adrenal, and hormone testing that also looks at melatonin. So if you've been told by your functional medicine guy before that you need to get the ASI test done, the spit test, I'll urge you not to and to get this test instead because it's a lot more accurate. And the clients that have already ordered this test through me have discovered they're not in stage 3 burnout like they said they were from the ASI test. They're in stage 1. And so now we just have some basic nutrient protocols and some supplements to really help them. So it's just, it makes me smile because it's just funny how once people get this diagnosis from a functional guy, oh crap, this must be the real deal. It may not be. You have to get the right type of testing, not just the testing. So contact me through my website, notjustpaleo.com, up at the top. You can read more about how the testing works and how your hormones are actually supposed to work. I made a pretty thorough write-up there for you. I also just got my first book deal through a publisher. I'm going to be publishing a book on nootropics. So my experience working on it and working behind the scenes of supplement formulation and research and all of my years of use of different things, whether it was herbs or vitamins or nutrients or what you would call smart drugs, it's finally come to help me out. And so I'm going to be writing this first book. I do have some podcasts in the bank, luckily, so there shouldn't be a delay in the show. But if you see that I miss a day or something like that, just know that I'm working deep in the trenches and that I'm thinking about you. So thanks for your encouragement and your support that's helped me get to this level. And I'm really thankful. Another thing is you're going to be seeing me hosting the Natural Stacks podcast. So more on that soon. That's going to be launching on May 4th. But let's get into the show. A lot of cool stuff happening. And pick up those lab tests back at the website. But here we go. All right. Welcome back to Not Just Paleo. I'm here with an awesome guest today. And I found him on YouTube, of all places. You wouldn't think that YouTube is the hub for health information, but the guy I'm about to bring on, Dr. Albert Mensa, is a guy who has an incredible talk on YouTube about mood disorders and how so many people are struggling in treating mood disorders, different things like autism to ADD and bipolar and anxiety and depression. And, you know, this is a topic that we talk about a lot, but I never get sick of hearing the ways that we can actually treat this naturally because it's just such an epidemic issue. So, Dr. Mensa, welcome.
Thank you very much, Evan.
Yeah, so I watched this video and I loved your sense of humor because it's really hard to talk about some of these subjects for people because they're so deeply rooted in, you know, negative emotions. So yes. I guess maybe before we talk about you, talk about the importance of adding humor to your health practice and how you have to make people laugh when you're talking about stuff as serious as, you know, bipolar disorder.
Absolutely. And it sounds cliche, Evan, but truly laughter is really key to medicine. When we're talking especially about depression, and it's a very difficult subject, you know, at some point in time, there has to be a little bit of levity trying to be introduced into the phenomenon. Otherwise, it just gets to be very, very difficult. And trying to help people move to a level that's uplifting is simply one of the things that you've got to just consider where humor can be interjected. You know, I often tell our patients when they come into our clinic, you know, they'll see that there is more of a lighthearted phenomenon here at Mensa Medical because that if we don't introduce some levity, you know, we can certainly become depressed ourselves. And we want to have as much humor as possible to help elevate the mood. And that makes people feel comfortable. And the more comfortable they feel, the more they're going to open up to understanding and internalizing what it is we're trying to share with them.
Definitely. So, I mean, what's your favorite form of humor? Do you play videos of cats jumping out of windows? Or what's your secret?
Well, for us, it really is a little bit more improvisational.
Yeah.
Whatever the circumstance happens to be, we take advantage of it. If it's one of our colleagues, one of our coworkers, somebody who might be doing something that just seems fairly neutral, but we see that there's an opportunity to inject some humor, that's what we do. My operations manager, for example, one day was standing in the middle of the room talking to one of our patients, and I just kind of coyly came up and hinted at the fact that she didn't actually work here and that she herself was depressed. And everyone knew that, of course, that was a joke, but nonetheless, the patients really felt uplifted by that kind of relaxed humor. And of course, I promptly apologized after that, letting everyone know that what the true situation was, but even she started laughing. So whatever the case may be, whatever the situation, we try to just take advantage of it.
That's great. Well, tell people a little bit about yourself. I love that you specialize. Your practice seems to show that you specialize in individuality, for one, the biochemical individuality that everyone has, as opposed to a blanket approach or a cookie cutter approach. But more specifically, it seems like you're focusing on some of my favorite topics of recently that are people that are over-methylating and under-methylating, and a lot of people are having issues with that, and that's probably close to half the population, it looks like. So how did you get into this specific field?
Well, Evan, before I even go there, what I want to say is thank you, first of all, in your sentence with over-methylation. There's been so much of a buzz and so much hype about under-methylation and the diagnosis and treatment thereof with regard to genetic testing, that many people don't realize that over-methylation actually exists. And that's why you can't go by genetic testing quite so blanketly, because it doesn't really test for over-methylation or the balance between under and over-methylation. So first of all, thank you there. Quite honestly, Evan, I'm a skeptic. I wasn't even interested in this field. I didn't even know about this field when I began. It all really began with my partner, Dr. Judith Bowman, bringing me into this field when there was a job opportunity at the now closed original Pfeiffer Treatment Center. And there she told me that they were, you know, treating people and helping people with schizophrenia and depression and anxiety and autism. And I said, oh, that's great. That's great. Wonderful. How are they doing that? And she said, well, with nutrients. And I said, oh, come on. Vitamins? You've got to be kidding me. Now, Evan, this was a serious deal at the time because I was just about to sign a very lucrative contract with another company in the western town of Illinois, western part of Illinois, and I saw retirement, you know, in my near future very comfortably. And not that I was of age, but that's how well they were going to be paying me. So when I came to this place and I saw the amazing things they were doing, I thought either this is the greatest sham on the planet, or this is the biggest, most cutting-edge phenomenon I've ever seen. Well, needless to say, almost a decade later, I'm still here doing this. So what was going on was real, it was important, and people got better without actually having to use pharmaceutical agents. But even better, if people were already on pharmaceutical agents, we could still help them in a parallel fashion with nutrient therapy. So number one, what they do and what we did opposed to medication, but at the same time, if you weren't on any medication when you started, you certainly didn't have to be. So we had to understand, first of all, who the individual person is. And that is, we don't simply use, I tell people all the time, Evan, listen, depression is not a diagnosis. Depression is a symptom. It is the expression of sometimes multiple chemical imbalances going on within one individual. Let me give you an example. Somebody who's deficient in zinc can become depressed. Somebody who's deficient in vitamin D can become depressed. Somebody who's got excessive levels of copper can be depressed. Somebody with either under or over methylation can be depressed. Now, I'm not going to go through all of the different elements that can cause depression, but right there we see that five different chemical imbalances can cause the symptoms of depression. So if you're going to treat depression as a diagnosis and not figure out what the actual cause is, you're going to try to create the same protocol to help all the people in the world who've got depression. And that's why some people don't get better. And some people may actually get better using traditional modalities. But the key to really helping the mass public do better is to test individually to find out where their imbalances lie and then to target those imbalances for correction and treatment.
That's great. Yeah, you mentioned the Pfeiffer Institute. I just got done reading Dr. Walsh's book, Nutrient Power, and I'm happy to hear that you were part of that, because that book blew me away. For people that haven't read that book, Nutrient Power is one of the best ones that I've ever read on the subject of mood disorders, and it outlines, I mean, basically what you're doing on a daily basis. So I guess, where do you think we should start in explaining this stuff to people? And when you're trying to identify what's actually going wrong, do you put someone through a certain testing protocol, or if someone's depressed, where do they start in your practice?
We start with a very thorough history. That's the most important thing. History tells us so much. When we look at, first of all, a very thorough conversation with our nursing staff before anything else happens, we're gathering historical tidbits, historical elements, when things began, what the individual patient has gone through in their whole journey with depression or anxiety or any kind of mood disorder. And they take roughly about 45 minutes with our nursing staff alone. Then they see us, the practitioners, the doctors. And when we speak to them, we also spend about an hour to an hour and a half with each patient. One of the things that we're all taught in medical school, Evan, is that the first thing you really want to do with any patient is to listen. So the goal is for the doctor to really just shut up and let the patient speak. The patient, most of the time, will tell you what is wrong with them if you listen. Now, when you move to family history, which is another piece that we incorporate into our diagnostic paradigm, we're getting bits and pieces of evidence of if somebody else had depression or anxiety or a different disorder. We know that the difference is that many of these phenomena are what we call epigenetic. And that's what Dr. Walsh mentions in his book. The whole idea of epigenetics, genetic phenomena, involves where the environment affects DNA and therefore changes what is called the expression or the manifestation of the problem. For example, somebody who's undermethylated may have depression, but their relative who's undermethylated may actually have anxiety, or maybe one of their other relatives may actually have ADHD. Each one is considered to be related to undermethylation, but how it shows up in the family is actually very different. Okay, so knowing family history, and that's what we do a genetic history, so to speak, on both sides of the family, both mother and father and cousins and aunts and uncles, etc. And all these things give us clues before we ever run a single test. The next piece that comes in is once we've gotten a thorough history and genetic history done, we now look at what we believe are the...
You froze just a little bit there, Dr. Mensa. If we could back it up, I'm going to leave my video off to make sure that we don't have any interruptions again. But you were talking about the next step after you get the genetic or sort of the family history.
Yes, after the family history... Then we're ready to sit down and put together a nutrient program. So what we do is we then start the testing process, the actual biochemical testing. So we'll look at different elements that we believe are contributing to the disorder based upon what we've heard from the personal history and the family history. So we will test for different elements in order to either confirm or deny what our suspicions are. So, for example, if we think that a person has a genetic history of overmethylation and their symptoms may involve elements that seem to look at overmethylation, we will test for overmethylation. In addition, we want to make sure that some of the basic elements are also within balance. So elements like zinc and copper and different other pieces that we want to incorporate. So it's really very simple, Evan, in general construct. The idea is first take a very thorough history. We do the patient history, the individual history, that is. Then we do family history, genetic history. Then we test. Now, once we get the test results back, we know what chemistries correlate with which symptoms. And so we put those constructs together, and that's how we create the nutrient protocol for each individual person. So this is how what we do is very targeted, come up with a therapeutic regimen for everyone.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, I mean, when someone says, oh, my mom was depressed or my mom had anxiety issues, I'm going to have that too. I mean, is some of that in your head? I mean, obviously, there's certain things that could be passed down, whether it's copper toxicity or things like that. But, I mean, how big of a role does the mind play in this whole picture of basically diagnosing yourself with an illness just because your family member had it?
That is a great question, Evan. And one of the things that people don't realize, and I have to say this, the brain and the mind are not one and the same. The brain is the structure in which the mind functions. So there are multiple sides in which things can go wrong. The actual structure of the brain may not work properly, and that's going to create cognitive dysfunction. But if the mind begins to tell itself that there's a problem, ultimately, it will have an effect on the structure of the brain and processing, and it will actually create a problem. So we have to be careful. We always say that words are powerful and they have creative force. Okay? And what we see is that if indeed you tell yourself something long enough, you may develop that very problem. Or if it's a positive message you're giving, you can elevate yourself in the appropriate directions. So we do know that, yes, you can indeed talk yourself into a depressive situation, into illness, into a variety of things. As some people would say, let your mantra be your guide in terms of your life. And speaking negative thoughts will produce negative manifestations. Speaking positive thoughts can be extremely helpful in terms of moving you in the right direction. So mind over matter, well, in part, and then there's the relationship between mind and matter. And both of them, excuse the term, matter.
That's great. Yeah, I mean, I had to ask that question because I see that sometimes people they almost want something. They like to have a name for their personality. I'm like this because I have blank. And I feel like you hold yourself back from the healing process because you're so attached to a label that you've been given, even if it was 20 years ago by a physician that is not as awesome as yourself, that doesn't really know the deep meaning behind something, and you'll just get a blanket diagnosis or a pseudo-diagnosis like IBS, for example, and then now you think you're destined to have digestive problems your whole life.
And that's a great point, Evan. Labels are a real problem, and I try to tell as many of our patients and as many of the people I consult with that labels are really questionable these days, because if you've got a chemical imbalance and that imbalance is corrected, and you no longer have the symptoms, did you actually ever have a diagnosis and therefore a label to begin with?
That's great.
What do you do with that information?
Yep, that makes great sense. Well, let's talk a little bit about, I guess, methylation in general, just so we could kind of get people up to speed on how this process happens in the body, why it's so important, and then maybe we could talk about some of the dysfunctions that many people seem to have.
Mm-hmm. Well, methylation is a process, as you've kind of indicated here. And it is the process by which a simple carbon molecule, one carbon molecule with three or four hydrogens attached. This molecule, I would say, is kind of like a Lego. It attaches onto other molecules. And when it does so, it actually changes the structure and therefore the function of the given molecule that it attaches to. So, for example, you know, all the enzymes and proteins and hormones and neurotransmitters that we have in our system, they're not just there always active. Most of the time, these elements are produced in an inactive form, and they have to be activated. So they've got to be turned on. And at the same time, what is turned on must be turned off. That's what methyl does. Methyl both activates and inactivates different enzymes, hormones, and neurotransmitters. So in traditional medicine, we'll look at, for example, levels of neurotransmitters in the system. What we don't typically look at is whether or not those things are active or inactive. We kind of pretty much assume they're active because they're present. And that's an incorrect assumption. Therefore, the process of methylation is really key because it sort of drives and regulates so many different processes in our bodies and in our minds, all the way down to the level of your DNA. DNA is in part going to be read by machinery that translates that blueprint into action. And you need methyl as a key part of that process. Now, in order to do anything, you've got to have methyl, so to speak, which means that you're going to have a certain amount or a certain concentration of methyl to get the job done. Now, some people don't have enough methyl to get that job done, and that's what we call under-methylation. Some people have too much methyl in their systems, and that's what we call over-methylation. And each one of those two constructs has its own ramifications. So the key piece here I want everyone to understand is that methylation is not simply a presence. It's an activity. It is a process in which actual molecules are attaching and detaching from other enzymes, hormones, neurotransmitters, and doing so, it changes the regulatory capacity, it changes the movement, it changes the action, it changes the expression of enzymes, hormones, and neurotransmitters. And we know that's how so much of our system functions or operates. So if you take away the car key, your car doesn't go anywhere. On the other hand, if your car is in the on position and for some reason the key gets stuck, you can't turn it off. You burn gas and your car peters out. So having the right amount of methyl is extremely key. And I just want to say that's one of the challenges of genetic testing. Genetic testing doesn't tell you how much methyl you actually have. It hints that one enzyme in the process of developing methyl may or may not be problematic. It doesn't actually test methyl. We have very simple testing, blood tests, that can actually tell you how much methyl is present. And we've been doing that for 40 and 50 years. So we have very specific ways of determining actual concentration of methyl, because that's what lets you, therefore, target a treatment protocol with accuracy and effectiveness.
That's great. So, I mean, what you're alluding to is, I'm guessing, the MTHFR, you know, sort of hysteria that's going on now.
Correct.
And everyone is saying, oh, I have the, you know, the one gene or the two SNPs or whatever. And then eventually everyone just throws themselves on methylfolate, which I've seen you have pretty bad issues with that sometimes, pretty bad side effects just by throwing that in just because you assume that you have that defect. So, I mean, what is, I guess, the proper way to do it? You test for methyl. Is there a certain type of test that's called?
Actually, it's blood histamine test.
Oh, okay.
Evan, a simple blood test, the whole blood histamine, gives you a great representation of how much methyl is actually in the system. And the reason is that the two constructs are diametrically opposed. Methyl actually suppresses histamine, and histamine actually suppresses methyl. So we know that if your histamine levels are high, your methyl is actually low in concentration. We're not worried about enzymes or hormones because what we're looking at here is the net effect of all methylation enzymes, whether it's over-methylation or under-methylation. They work either together or in diametric opposition to produce methyl. So when we look at a construct like histamine, and we know that it works diametrically opposed to methyl, we can actually use that as a marker for true under or over methylation based upon that test result. So here we're not dealing with the possibility of genetic inference. THFR test is not quantitative. It is at best qualitative. It says that maybe this enzyme is working properly, maybe it's not, maybe it's partially not functioning. You don't really know. And that's why so many practitioners, Evan, simply get very questionable results, and so many patients and people aren't getting better with that form of testing because it doesn't test everything. You'd have to test all the enzymes involved in under-methylation and all the enzymes involved in over-methylation, and then you're still going to be guessing as to how much methyl you've actually produced. Evan, we keep it simple. Find out how much methyl is there to begin with, plain and simple, and then you can treat accordingly.
It's so mind-blowing that being specific, the specificity of health, everyone likes to pinpoint the one silver bullet. You get tested for this gene mutation, and all of a sudden, everything is going to be fixed. And of course, there's some marketing and things behind that for people to convince you that that's the only thing that matters. But it's blowing my mind right now that you're saying that we're overcomplicating everything once again, and we just need to zoom out and look at, you know, look at these levels here. Is there an optimal range that you could share us with about, you know, what should that number actually be if you go and get histamine levels tested?
If we're looking at what we consider to be a normal functional range, that range tends to be between the numbers 40 and 70. And the closer you move to either extreme, the more you're looking at either overmethylation or undermethylation, respectively.
Okay, so where would you like to start next? Should we start, you know, talking about overmethylation a little bit, since that's sort of excluded, I guess, from this sort of alternative health world?
Mm-hmm. We can certainly begin there. What I would like to share is that when it comes to genetics and these SNPs that everyone is concerned with, a SNP is simply a genetic mutation. And I want to share with everyone listening, every single one of us walking this planet has over 1,000 SNPs. And almost all of them bear little relevance to our actual day-to-day functioning. We're all here. This has been going on since the dawn of time. It's genetic mutation that allows us to evolve. Okay, so because your genes say you may have a SNP here or a SNP there, there's no reason to panic. Quite earnestly, most people outside of the realm of autism, most individuals with SNPs in the MTHFR, really, it's not very relevant to their particular situation. It's a huge, huge molecule, and to assess that one possible aberration is going to the functionality of one enzyme is not really what the science and the evidence is really proving or showing up to be. But let's talk about overmethylation. What's really interesting about overmethylation is that individuals here have so much methyl that all of their systems are sort of in hyperdrive. They are the people who tend to be very creative. Their minds are constantly going. They have a hard time settling down or sort of shutting things off. And they'll tell you that. They ruminate. They tend to be very creative people. We often find them in the artistic world, our artists, our philosophers, our poets. I call them the easy, smooth, jazz-listening, you know, kind of folks. They look very calm and relaxed on the outside. But unfortunately, Evan, they tend to have a great deal of inner tension, and it eats at them extremely. They may never really show it externally, but their internal structure is literally just dying. They're very passionate people. On the positive side, these are folks whom, you know, if you're ever sick and you're in a hospital, you would want to have an overmethylated nurse. She will be there at your bedside holding your hand through the wee hours of the morning and caring for your every need. They often give well above and beyond themselves, even to the exclusion of themselves. They tend to be extremists in that way, and that's one of the really hard parts for them. For them, depression and anxiety are tremendously powerful elements because they feel it deeply within their bosom, within their system. And that's why, even though their chemistry may suggest a challenge, the actual manifestation symptomatically is much, much greater. These are also the same people who, by the way, when they're started on antihistaminic medications, many of the SSRIs as a category, many of the atypical antipsychotics, the very important or well-popularized antihistaminic medications, many of these people will become more and more depressed, and they pose a very high risk, a very high risk, to suicide or homicidal behavior. And generally, these responses occur within about 3 weeks of the time that they've started therapy with any of these medications. Now, unlike the undermethylators tend to do very well with those self-same categories of medications. And that has to do with the neurotransmitter capacity on both sides. Overmethylators tend to have high levels of serotonin, dopamine, and norepinephrine. So when you give them an SSRI, their serotonin levels will rise, further worsening their condition. Whereas when you give an undermethylator, an SSRI, they tend to have low levels of serotonin, dopamine, and norepinephrine. So it actually benefits them by raising their serotonin levels. So we can see here that with both over- and undermethylation, there are two diametrically opposed biochemical constructs with pharmacological ramifications. This is why we talk so heavily about the accuracy of finding out whether you are an undermethylator, normally methylating, or overmethylating, because it can literally mean the difference between life and death. And that's based upon which kind of drug you might be treated with or might be benefited by or might be causing harm to you. And we've seen it already in this country. When you are harmed because of the wrong medication and you turn around and you shoot someone, it's not just your life that's been affected. It's now the lives of literally thousands of other people throughout history. One person makes a big difference. One person spawns an entire lineage of family members throughout the decades and the centuries. So we've got to be careful. It's not just one person. One person, every person is important. And we've got to treat people that way. It's not good enough to guess about someone's chemistry if you're going to treat that person. You've got to be accurate and you've got to be certain. And you've got to know what to do with those situations where there may be a questionable balance or imbalance in between.
Yeah, that's definitely profound. And I think you're alluding to, I believe it was the Columbine shooting. I can't remember when that was now, but I believe, and you know, fill me in if I'm wrong, but I believe both of the kids had just started or were currently on SSRIs at the time.
Correct.
So they must have been over-methylators.
Precisely. And quite honestly, Evan, Dr. Walsh has evaluated a good number of the shootings over the course of the past several years. And he believes that most of these individuals were over-methylators and were just given the wrong medication because we were not aware as a whole group that by testing histamine first, we could have made better selections with regard to the medication choices. We were going by what we do know as a medical society, which is that these meds help these conditions. And this is why I say there's the fallacy in medicine about diagnosis. These are symptoms, they're clues, but you've got to find the underlying chemistry, which can actually help you guide your therapy, whether it's pharmacological or not. It's not the medications themselves that are bad. No one is saying that. What we're saying, though, is that just like anything else, you've got to have the right treatment for the right person. And if you don't know who that person is biochemically, you're not going to be successful with regard to their treatment protocols.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I want to zoom out just a little bit because I'm just so impressed by your grasp at the big picture of this and how it's affecting society as a whole. And a lot of people, even myself, I'm looking at the world and it looks a lot different than even when I was a kid, which wasn't that long ago. And a lot of people are fearful because they think everyone's going crazy. And I'm curious about what are some of the day-to-day actionable things outside of testing and nutrient therapy that people may be able to do to sort of at least save their own sanity in a way. I mean, I guess what I'm trying to ask specifically here is if diet and lifestyle can make a big enough impact on methylation or just in general to get yourself out of the hole.
That's a great question, Evan, and the answer is yes and no. The key with regard to that, first of all, diet and exercise are always important. You've got to, and everyone knows that. No one is ever going to question that. Okay. But here's the deal. How do you know which diet is best for you? Everyone talks about this diet or that diet, and I'm paleo, I'm a vegetarian, I'm a carnivore, I'm this, I'm that. But here's the real question. How do you know that's the best diet for you? Well, some people say, well, I'm blood type this or I'm blood type that, and I go with the blood type diet or I go with this, or it's trial and error. One of the things that we do at Mensa Medical is that we look at a person's chemistry. From that chemistry, we can actually determine what is the better lifestyle dietary regimen for you. And I'll just make it very clean and simple. For example, undermethylators really should not be vegetarians. On the other hand, they can graze all day long. They're great with dark green leafy vegetables. The problem here is the folate concentration. Undermethylators should not be exposed to high levels of folate. it'll actually dive into the nucleus of the cell where the DNA sits, and it will steal methyl, okay? That's like saying to somebody who's poor, okay, listen, I'm going to give you a crispy $1 bill, a brand new $1 bill, but I'd like you to give me 10 old crumpled up dollar bills. That doesn't sound like much of a deal there, now, does it? But that's what folic acid does to an undermethylator. When you even take, for example, methylated folate, that methylated folate will give you one methyl, but it'll steal 10. So for undermethylators, diets that are rich in folic acid, which just happens to be the dark green leafy vegetables, okay, soy protein, satay, lutein, all these things that we tend to think are generally healthy for the body, are actually going to be very detrimental for someone cognitively, for the mind. On the other hand, if somebody is an overmethylator, they need to have those excess methyl molecules removed. And, you know, the greater concentration of dark green leafy vegetables in their system, the better off they are dietarily. So let's look at the big picture here. Somebody who's got depression, and really, Evan, this discussion is focused around people with cognitive health imbalances. Other people would call it mental health issues. For somebody who's anxious or depressed, you really should find out what your chemical status is first before embarking on any dietary regimen. We have seen people who are depressed and undermethylators move further and further in the direction of vegetarianism to the point where they almost died. And they're publicly telling their story. Now, on the other hand, overmethylators who've moved in that direction begin to lead wonderful lives. So in reality, there probably should be more protein and more animal protein, believe it or not. Yes, I'm going to go out there and say it, for individuals who are undermethylated. Those are going to be the best sources of methyl for them. Okay. On the other hand, people who are overmethylated really should gravitate towards diets that tend to have more of the dark green leafy vegetables. Now, Evan, here's the real irony. Based upon clinical evidence, I find a fascinating and curious trend in that people who tend to be undermethylators tend to gravitate towards more vegetable-type diets. People who are overmethylators, and for the life of me, I still haven't understood why. It's almost a cosmic joke, if you will, that the certain chemistries are attracted to the diametrically opposed dietary regimens when there is extremism. Okay. Now, most people tend to sit in a balanced lifestyle. So what we're seeing, Evan, is that really our ancestors, our great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents were correct when they would say, eat a balanced diet. Because when you eat a balanced diet, you're not going to get too much of the methyl, you're not going to get too much of the folate, you're not going to get too much of the vegetables or too much of the meats, and you're going to stay in a non-detrimental, neutral position as far as the diet affecting the mind and processing of the mind. Okay? Now, I know there are a lot of people out there who are saying, well, wait a minute. This is not what we're hearing from, you know, whatever medical association about our bodies and cancer and all those fun things. We can tell you now, some of the latest studies with cancer are actually showing that people who are having lots of folates in their system can actually be worsening their condition relative to cancer. And people who are taking in lots of methyl can actually be benefiting because methyl tends to be very protective against cancer gene activation. And this is coming from the latest news in the hematology oncology journals, some of the most respected in this entire country. And so there's a shifting paradigm around nutrition and diet. And once again, for everyone, I want to really mention that this is about cognitive health. We're talking about mental health. We're not talking about just the physical person. Physically and mentally, I think we would all do better if we ate certainly fewer processed foods, like everyone is saying, and then more of a balanced regimen. Now, if you happen to know your chemistry, then by all means, you know, if you're an overmethylator, you know, go become a bunny rabbit. You know, graze all day long if you wish. Eat your dark green leafies. If you're an undermethylator, yes, indeed, eat your carnivorous creatures and so forth. But remember, even though we're talking about what should be predominantly in the diet, it doesn't mean that you exclude those other things. Everyone should have vegetables in their diet, okay? Plain and simple, without question. It's good mechanically for the colon. It's good in terms of everything else that it does relative to your GI tract, okay? So we're not saying be exclusive or an extremist. We're saying if you're going to move in that direction, know first what your chemistry is saying that your system needs before you make those extreme decisions. Now, we know there are people who are philosophically inclined to not want to move in one direction or another, but we can't guard against that. We can't do much about that. Your personal choice is your personal choice. All we do is we interpret, so to speak, the chemistry of the situation, and then we inform, and then everyone makes their choice accordingly. So once we're informed, though, as someone once said, you are now responsible for your information. And what you choose, if it's diametrically opposed to who you are, then really you've got to take some of the onus for how you're going to be living, whether it's depressed, anxious, happy, or sad, for yourself. Okay? We can only inform.
That was a great explanation, and I've been looking for somebody like you to really break down the diet picture for at least probably 5 years or so. So I'm really thankful, you know, for you to give that information, because there's a lot of Vitamix pushers out there that want people to shovel, you know, 20 scoops of kale into their blender every morning. And
like, oh, yes.
You know, and of course people get concerned about oxalates and things like that as well. But to actually hear another viewpoint of why you may not want to do that is awesome. So thank you so much for that.
Oh, absolutely. We've had several of those conversations with not just patients, but entire nutritional educators, physicians. We've had and actually cancer treatment specialists, and many of them have been shocked in terms of what's happening even in their own specialty and are changing their regimens. The concept of the green smoothie for every cancer patient is no longer being observed by all the oncologists out there. They're starting to change as well, based upon the information that we're providing.
That is great. So I feel like I'm probably missing out on one specific topic or one piece of this puzzle. I know we don't have too much time together left, but you know, specifically regarding the depression and anxiety issue, it's such a huge epidemic. And if people get the methylation picture figured out and they start, you know, tuning their diet or twisting their diet a little bit and tweaking it to optimize for their own biochemistry, is the next step to bring in some of the nutrients?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, what we say in terms of treatment is actually to start the nutrients first, because that's where the power is coming in. Diet, it's very hard to actually treat disorders like that with diet. In fact, most people couldn't possibly eat their way into that kind of health. When we're talking about major depression, major anxiety, schizophrenia, bipolar, ADHD, those sorts of things, diet is a help. But because these tend to be epigenetic phenomenon or genetically stimulated issues, you've got to override high concentrations of nutrients. Now, this is not willy-nilly. These are hand-calculated by the physician. So we're not talking about giving toxic levels of any nutrients. And by the way, nutrients can be toxic. So people shouldn't try this on their own. Take into account all the testing, the symptoms, everything that we're exploring. We have to actually hand calculate every nutrient. We have to make sure, in terms of concentration, that is. We then have to make sure that the nutrients don't conflict with one another. In other words, even in a multivitamin that's standard, they contain elements that simply are counterintuitive. Zinc and calcium bind each other. You can't take the two at the same time. Yet look at a multivitamin and you'll see both present in the same capsule. So they negate each other. So when we're doing these programs or protocols for patients, we take into account what elements they need, when they can take them, how much to take, in order to try to even do this from a dietary perspective. Evan, I always say it's like that commercial where they would say, you'd have to eat 13 bowls of total cereal 3 times a day to equal the amount of zinc that's present in this one capsule. Okay. It's typically just not going to happen from a dietary perspective in terms of treating cognitive pathology. Now, diet is an ancillary phenomenon that can actually be more harmful than helpful if you're doing this in an extreme form. But it is certainly important to eat right, without question. That can help the situation tremendously. But people with major cognitive challenges, there's usually a chemical reason why, and that's what has to be addressed by an equally powerful, in fact, even more powerful nutrient protocol.
Makes sense. So are there any, I guess, blanket supplements that most people end up on? Like, I'm going to assume that zinc is pretty popular just because I've seen so much copper toxic people, and you know, the soil is not containing the minerals like it used to, and rainwater could even rinse the zinc off of your vegetables and things like that. Is zinc one of those blanket supplements?
Well, the way I look at it, Evan, is that it's not just zinc. I mean, there's so many elements that are necessary. The body and the brain multitask. They use the same elements to work in different capacities everywhere. So really, that's where eating a varied diet comes in very handy, because this is where you're finding all the different minerals and all the different vitamins that are necessary. In terms of extra supplementation, and I'm not going to comment on concentrations, but I would say that zinc, certainly, vitamin B6, certainly, are two of the most important elements that anyone could take. In addition, yes, calcium and vitamin D. There are a plethora of certain elements that are key in our system. But what we find so much in the stressed out world is that people tend to be very depleted in at least these two elements. And I'm not saying, and please, everyone, don't go run out and buy, you know, 50,000 units of anything. But from an educational perspective, we know that diets that are low in zinc, or individuals who are low in zinc and vitamin B6, certainly tend to have more depression. And that's because they're very important in making neurotransmitters, especially serotonin and dopamine and norepinephrine. And our calming neurotransmitter, we call it GABA, G-A-B-A. That's gamma-aminobutyric acid. These are elements that are very key. But one more time, these things have to be calculated for age, for concentration, and for a variety of other elements that come into play. It is not a simple process, and no one should try to do this on their own. You can become very toxic very easily, and that's not what you want to have happen. You've got to work with a skilled practitioner on these constructs. But what you find in a multivitamin, a little bit of zinc, a little bit of B6, a little bit of B12, a little bit of calcium, not necessarily a bad thing, but you can't put them all in the same construct, not in the same multivitamin.
Right, yeah, thanks for making that distinction. A quick story that I did. You know, I got a hair test that said, oh, you're copper toxic. So I started taking 50 milligrams of zinc, just a sort of blanket zinc supplementation. I started taking that, and I felt worse, probably. I mean, I'm guessing you're going to agree, but I'm guessing I just started dumping too much into the system, and I was either flushing out or something was going on with copper where I felt worse. So then I eventually backed down and realized that 50 milligrams of zinc was way too much for me.
Well, you know, there are a few pieces to that. One of the things is that, once again, you really have to have that adjusted for your particular system and all aspects. You wouldn't believe how many things are examined in order to come up with a nutrient protocol for a person. It's not just usually just one test or one piece. So there may have been something that wasn't taken into account in your protocol there, Evan, and maybe that's why you felt so bad. So, yes, your system, by the way, may not have adjusted or been adjusted to taking higher concentrations of that zinc. You may have supercharged your system too hard and didn't have time to adapt. So a variety of things could have happened. It's hard to say, but certainly we see, and you're a great example, of how just taking an element can be problematic without the proper guidance or guidelines.
Right. I mean, it's funny because everyone wants to be their own health detective now. And they know that they're deficient in something, but they don't know what, so they just start picking random things off the shelf because it's in the energy section, and then they take it, and then they don't know why they're not getting better. So I guess at that point, that's when they need to come see you and get a hold of some of your people and yourself, because in my opinion, and this isn't even tooting your horn, you have the best protocol approach that I've found and discovered, and I've been interviewing people like yourself for, you know, coming up on 3 years now. So, you know, I commend you for that.
Oh, thank you, Evan. We appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, cool. Well, tell people, if you had any last words of wisdom or, you know, something that you want people to take away from this, you could tell us that and then give us your information to get in contact and keep up with all your work.
First of all, I want to say never give up. And most of the people who are out there searching and listening to this program are in that category. They're not giving up. Number two, what somebody throws is a label on you, because that label may not truly exist. Depression is a symptom, and I know I'm going to hear a lot from other my colleagues and so forth, but I don't believe depression is an actual diagnosis. It's a disorder. Why? Because we've seen several different chemistries, up to 7 or 8, that can cause that symptom. And when you treat those imbalances, patients get better. And if you don't have symptoms, you don't have a diagnosis. So keep that in mind. But the other key piece is that you can't do guesswork here. This is not just about nutrition. This is actually how nutrient science fits in to all the other medical sciences. It is not a simple process. We have to take into consideration things like your thyroid, things like diabetes, things like hypertension. All those typical medical constructs get involved in the decision making as to what to do and how to do it. So don't try this on your own. That's a real danger. Many people have done more harm. Some people have ended up in hospitals because they've tried protocols or things that they didn't have true medical guidance with regard to. So those are the key. The hope is alive, as many politicians might say. And that's what I want everyone to keep in mind. There is hope out there for you. You just have to keep looking. Keep looking. You will find it. Don't let traditional medicine tell you that there is no other way. That is not true. Thanks to the original Dr. Carl Pfeiffer, thanks to Dr. William Walsh, and people who've come before us, we know for fact that that previous statement is incorrect. Okay, and there are a lot of people who can testify to, so to speak, that sort of thing. Mensa Medical is located in Warrenville, Illinois. You can contact us. We're just outside of Chicago. You can contact us at telephone number, area code 630-256-8308. Or go to our website at www.mensamedical.com. We've got outreach clinics on the West Coast in Northern and Southern California, as well as Arizona. And on the East Coast, we have Baltimore, Maryland area, as well as in Southern United States, Fort Lauderdale, Florida. So feel free to give us a call, or if you just want to ask a question, there is no charge for that. Be more than happy to talk to you. Certainly gather as much information as you can and continue to inform yourselves. So much is changing in the world, and we've got to try to keep up. But the most important thing that's changing is hope. We're seeing now that there's so much hope for every disorder, from autism to schizophrenia to anxiety to depression. We no longer live in the dark ages of medicine, where all we said was, there really is no hope for you. So if any of you ever hear that, listen, you call me and we'll talk.
Awesome. I appreciate that. Thank you so much for your time.
Evan, thank you for having us on your show.
Definitely. All right. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Dr. Mensa. And it's funny that testing accurately is one of the most important aspects of his healthcare business, because for me, since I've offered, I don't know if you heard this on the last podcast, but since I'm now offering a urinary adrenal and hormone panel test, I've discovered that many people who have previously had the SPIT test done, you know, the ASI adrenal stress index test, the SPIT test, people that were supposedly in stage 3 adrenal fatigue, people that have ordered this test through me have now discovered that they were only in stage 1 adrenal fatigue and that they don't need to be doing all of the things that they're doing to recover. And so I've actually adjusted some supplement and nutrient protocols to help people come out of the hole a lot easier, because they're not as deep in the hole as they thought they were. So this just goes to show the importance of not just getting tested, but getting the right testing done. So I'm happy to run these tests on you. I have a new batch of tests available. Currently, I have 5 tests available. I can always order more, but these will go quick. So just put T-E-S-T in the subject line of an email and send that to notjustpaleo@gmail.com. That's the best way I can find it. And we can talk further about that, how it works, but it's amazing to see what's happened so far. The people that have had ASI tests run, and then I show them the lab results from this and tell them, look, this is more accurate. You're not as burnt out as you thought you were. So it's a great sigh of relief for many people. If you want to read more about that testing, you can go to my website, notjustpaleo.com, and look in the menu bar, and at the top, you'll see adrenal and hormone testing. And I wrote a pretty big page there describing the proper circadian rhythm, how melatonin and your stress hormone cortisol are supposed to work, and then what happens when those get messed up. So go back to the website and you can read that there, and you can also order that lab test there, and I can get that shipped out to you. So I'll talk to you next week, and take great care of yourself. Bye.
I take it all good, yeah, like everything's cool. Kiss her girl goodnight and then he leaves her. She doesn't have a clue that he's terrible news. Why I'm in the tire, got to watch out, girl. Don't wanna see her cry her eyes out, girl. Cause I've been watching, you've been hurting. Let me be